You are unique, active, determined, resilient. You are not your diagnosis, and you are not alone. This is Young Onset Parkinson's Network. We believe young onset Parkinson's disease does not define you. You define it. We are a safe place to learn, connect, and engage within a supportive community that actually gets it, because we've got it too. Welcome to Young Onset Parkinson's Network. Living well starts here.
Today's episode has a deeply personal significance for me. Understand, I have had Parkinson's for 17 years now, and I deal with cognitive issues that make it challenging for me to articulate my thoughts clearly and concisely. It is essential to note that these issues are not indicative of dementia or any similar condition. In fact, my thoughts remain lucid as ever. However, after battling Parkinson's for 17 years, I've encountered various hurdles when it comes to expressing myself effectively. This is where Robert enters the picture. He's been a game changer for me and many others. Dr. Cochran is on a mission to teach individuals like me how to convey your thoughts and experiences through writing. Now, if you're part of the Parkinson's community, you've likely heard of Dr. Robert Cochran, and for good reason. His expertise and dedication to helping people like me find your voice again are truly remarkable. So I invite you to tune into this episode and take a journey with me. Let's explore how Robert's teaching has transformed my ability and others to express themselves and connect to others in the PD community. Thank you for listening. Up next, we have Dr. Robert Cochran along with my co-host Nathan Lee Ward and Heather Kennedy.
Yes, and we've got Robert Cochran here, folks, PhD Robert Cochran from UNLV, in a very interesting area of study. So I'll let you kind of take over and tell us about Yes And. Tell us about your education, because it's interesting where you come into the Parkinson's world.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Yes And Exercise is the nonprofit that was born out of the PhD study in the Interdisciplinary Health Sciences Program at UNLV, as you mentioned. And I came in with the proposal to them to say, I want to study the effect of improvisation on Parkinson's. And the hot buzzword in 2019 in higher education was interdisciplinary. And so these departments, kinesiology and PT and nutrition, a few others, were under an umbrella that said, yeah, we want to form a new type of degree. And that's what it was. So I was in the first class. And, you know, in going forward, I was frankly a little surprised they accepted me. I don't have a science background outside of the PhD world. I got my master's in journalism and media studies, as a filmmaker, been a teacher, certainly a big fan of academia in general. But this is a big leap going to the science side. And the sciences I had studied were more along sociology, psychology, certainly a fan of the academic research in that regard, but again, a big jump. So it was a difficult matriculation. I'll leave the full of that story for another time. I'll shorthand it by saying I have a one-man show called My DIY MF PhD, and it speaks towards some of the struggles that were involved with it. The good thing that kept me through it throughout were a couple things. One, my dad was diagnosed with Parkinson's in 2001. So I had deep purpose for what I was doing. And that put me in a rare space for a lot of PhD students. A lot of them are there more exploratory towards an issue or towards a career, all of which are fine pursuits. I had a very linear pursuit towards the Parkinson's community based on the people I'd met and my father. So along the way, there was one class that basically cracked me open a little bit, and it was a grant writing class that said, well, you can't do this to all of us, can't do exactly your field of study. We want you to consider how could you build upon your study. And so I said, okay, instead of directly improvisation's effect on Parkinson's, which I will do, how about storytelling? As a background, as a filmmaker, I'd studied the hero's journey. Joseph Campbell's work is a big part of my life and what I applied to screenwriting. So I said, I'm going to put that forward in a grant proposal. Well, there was one person in class who got it. I got a lot of blank stares. But the one student who did get it, it was a student, not the professor, really started pushing me and prodding me. And I had a fellow in the Luruvu Institute, a doctor named Dr. Mari, who said, yeah, you should apply for a real, you know, apply for an actual grant with this. And I was like, fine. So I applied for an improv grant, which I was sure was going to get community funding. And then the storytelling one, which I'm like, we'll see what happens. Of course, the improv doesn't get funded. The storytelling does. And it's like, okay, I guess I have to do this now. So that became the two pushes through, which for my dissertation was the effect of now improvisation and storytelling and the relationship on Parkinson's quality of life, not just for the people with Parkinson's, but for the people affected by, care partners, family members, as well as where we're going into the wellness and medical providers too, because they have a big effect on how the disease is experienced and what the truth of the disease is for people. And that's where it's led to today. So we still have the improvisation programs. What Michael has begun on a journey with, which I'm really excited about, is this program, the storytelling side, called Day One, The Parkinson's Prison and the Hero's Journey to Escape. And that really has become the main focus. People have really responded big to it. And there's a lot of opportunity for people who go through the program to gain their story, their understanding of their story, and what they'll do with it, both for their own quality of life and how they'll affect their families and the Parkinson's community in a positive way.
But I'm also very curious, the hero's journey, if you could enlighten our listeners a little bit more on that and how it applies within your mind to Parkinson's.
Sure. The hero's journey is the mythic structure by Joseph Campbell. He's the originator. Came up with this idea of the monomyth. Yeah, Michael's got his hand up. What's up, Mike?
Can you explain exactly who Joe Campbell is for anybody who doesn't know?
Yeah, Joseph Campbell is an academic, lived from really prominent from the mid-1940s till the mid-1980s when he passed. And his area of research was into historical mythology and the way cultures from the beginning of time were basically telling the same story, right? The thing he called the monomyth, right? That there were stages that we could recognize in what everyone was doing in their storytelling in order to communicate their truth, their lives. It's how for thousands of years we passed on, down knowledge before we learned the skills of writing and by, you know, oral storytelling or artwork, and then eventually written stories that were the assumed knowledge and the precious gold that people were able to hand off to each other, say, this is why we are what we are and how we will continue to survive and thrive. So it's not, in a modern sense, we think of storytelling from very much from an entertainment standpoint. However, psychologically, we are hardwired to both tell and receive stories for informational and truly survival purposes. And that alone, that understanding starts to crack people open because they understand, well, wait a minute, what stories am I telling myself about my own life? What belief systems have I taken in? Who is dictating the terms of what I believe? And that leads toward the Parkinson's prison, which is the stories that we tell ourselves that say, I can't, I shouldn't, or that has passed me by. You could take that as isolation or apathy. And we challenge those things within the program through storytelling and providing this hero's journey. There are 12 stages in the version we use, and it's only one version that allow the participants to go through and explore week by week, stage by stage. This is who I am. This is what I'm feeling. This is my version of my story. And we run it against both each other's. We read each other's stories and we watch The Shawshank Redemption, which is my favorite film and a spectacular version of a prison story with more than just kind of the trope of the grit of the prison. It is a story about the psychological elements and, you know, the power of hope within that space to break out of that space.
Now, I've heard feedback from multiple people that have been in this program and they absolutely love it. And I'm starting to understand why. This is very interesting stuff that you've got going here. What on earth, I guess I can answer my own question because you've already said it. Like I said, you're not leaving me very many questions, Robert. Your interest in this definitely was probably driven by your experience in the film industry. Can you step back and give us a little bit of insight on your history within that industry?
You bet. Mid-90s, my goal is to become a screenwriter. And, you know, I studied at UCLA and absolutely loved it. It was more than a passion. It was an obsession. And spent the next 5.5 years really getting lost there, both from a writing standpoint, then an acting standpoint. Early stages of improvisation happened there. And got a couple of films made that I wrote in an independent scene. One got a semi-release from what was a big distribution company called Artisan Entertainment at the time. It's called The Play Is Court. Had for those who are in the know, there's a rapper by the name of Sticky Fingers who was in it. Charles Malik Whitfield, who did a little bit of work, is in it. Charlie Robinson, who was Mac in Night Court, was in it. So there was, you know, it got a little bit of play. It was a good little story. So those things were all on the narrative side, right? The shift toward documentary didn't happen for me until years later, after my dad's diagnosis with Parkinson's. And, you know, we decided to, in a desire to figure out what Parkinson's was and what we'd do with it, we ended up taking a 2-month, 20,000-mile road trip to see a game at each of the 30 major league ballparks. And we documented that, right? Meeting people along the way. What is the state of Parkinson's? What's our role within it? This is 2004. So that was, you know, my background with it. That was an application of, you know, my skills in a different way. And it led to some, you know, real powerful storytelling that helped us set a foundation for what we would do with Parkinson's. Because I think early on, anybody who gets diagnosed wonders, okay, how in the world am I going to navigate this thing? Because all the evidence points toward I'm going to have it for a long time. Right. That's the interesting thing about a chronic illness versus an acute. My mom actually got diagnosed with breast cancer stage 4 2 weeks before my dad getting diagnosed. So we got to see both ends. Mom's a survivor, I'm happy to say. However, the first couple of years of my dad's Parkinson's diagnosis, we didn't even look at it really because we were, you know, focused on mom. And then the glacial unfolding of what this Parkinson's thing is, that's how we began to unfold it through storytelling, really. We decided to share that. So that's the back.
Robert, I can say you're a very good teacher because you got me to open my mind up and start writing what it was coming down the pipe. When it was coming through my mind, you got me to write it down.
He must be good if he opened your mind.
Well, that's the yes and thing. And by the way, I want to yes and welcome one of my favorite people. I see Heather is here.
Hi.
Heather, we've renamed the podcast, just so you know, Heather. It's now called Waiting on Heather. Which, so Robert, you already know Heather. It sounds like she's our storyteller of the group.
Robert's amazing. He was so handsome in that movie with Sticky Fingers too. He really outdid Sticky Fingers by many miles. Just
he also is as nice as he seems. I didn't meet him in Spain.
I know.
Just as nice.
It's true. We have this joke. I always tell his friend Susan when I first met him, I was like, this guy cannot be for real. There's no such thing as G. Willikers, It's a Wonderful Life. There is a Wonderful Life guy. He's right here and he's the real deal.
Well, I hate to tell you, Heather, he's already answered every question we've got. So
We got more questions.
All right. Shoot him his way. This guy is really interesting. And you, I think, Robert, the biggest thing that you bring to your program is yourself. Your persona is, what's the right word for it, Heather? You know what I'm thinking here.
Vivacious, effervescent.
There you go.
Energetic.
These are all wonderful and very kind words, and I thank you for all of them. The goal of this, and really the baseline of improvisation, is mirroring, right? That whenever someone gives us something, it's to reflect that back to give to everyone. So all the kindness and love you offer to me, I can only do with if I give it away to say thank you all for being, you know, beautiful, wonderful, awesome people that allow this to happen. Yes, my dear Heather.
Who can mirror Parkinson's patients? We're like this. Let's talk about the masking. How to get by the masking.
Well, you know, I think yes and it, Heather, is really, you know, get honest about masking. You know, one of the things that's come out of the research in a really interesting way is exactly that the performative element of Parkinson's that people don't realize is that they perform to look. And I think someone attributed this to you recently, Heather. I heard this in a group. Michael might have mentioned it, that a lot of people with Parkinson's perform well in a social space so that they don't, quote unquote, burden or bother other people with their symptoms. And then they suffer like crazy behind the scenes. And that is utter madness, that you can't be your whole self. Is that right, Heather?
But yes, that is true. And Larry often says, and I will quote Larry Gifford on this, he'll say, I spend half the time after I tell people I have Parkinson's calming them down. Watching their fears, their problems. Because everybody's bringing what their relationship to disease and discomfort is into the room. It's like when you go to a funeral, you know, you bring your memories of your loss in, not just the bereaved standing in front of you.
That's similar to my dad's line, which I think you probably know too, and we have it on the t-shirt. It says, relax, it's just effing Parkinson's, right? That he says he hates going out in public sometimes because, you know, they'll see him maybe freezing up or having a tough time. And as he says, they'll look at him like he's about to die. And he's like, calm down. Let's not minimize it and act like it's nothing, because that's a problem. But let's also not act like we're in the funeral already, right? There's got to be some kind of middle road we can get to understand and live well truthfully with Parkinson's.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you've got Nate here. He's still a stripper. If he could do it, you know, we could do it.
Everybody's got to make money somehow, people. So I'm curious, Robert, storytelling in general, it seems to be more of a tradition of cultures of the past, or, you know, cultures of the third world now currently. It's just kind of ingrained into different cultures. Whereas in the United States, we've kind of lost that side of our culture, and we kind of allow media to fill in that part of our culture. Do you see your program kind of taking people back to a more human nature that we're supposed to be living in? And is that kind of where the medicine is in here, doctor?
I thought you didn't have any questions. That's a brilliant question. So I love the idea of people being removed from their own story. And yes, I believe in that exactly, because we are such consumers of media that we take on other people's versions of stories and make them our own without reflecting on our own, right? Everybody, and Parkinson's is a perfect disease to dive into this, because we all know you met one person with Parkinson's, you met one person with Parkinson's. So when there is a thought leader, whether it is a doctor, well-meaning, or of another person with Parkinson's telling their story, that's great. What Campbell teaches us is, when we're on our journey, if the journey into the woods is too easy, we're probably on someone else's path. It's supposed to be hard to go and, you know, from an irritating standpoint, rewire, remap our minds to thinking on our own terms. And that means accepting our feelings. That means accepting our senses. That means saying, this makes sense, this doesn't. That means being scared and lost and fearful, and doing all of that with hopefully a yes and attitude that, like Michael said, allows us to freely just say, hey, this is what I think. And you know, and that gets us forward. Yeah, Heather.
And the first rule of comedy or improv is to be vulnerable, which I learned the hard way. I was in improv trying to be really clever. I had all these little phrases that I had memorized, and I would pull them into different skits. And, you know, Robert leans in, he goes, you know, you can just be yourself here. Something along those lines. I mean, it was really gentle. You could have just been like, cut the crap, Kennedy, you know, it's perfect. And what a lesson to just come as you are. What a beautiful way to be able to let things go and just be who you are in that moment. Like, we might show up frozen or not, doesn't matter. Robert will still work with you. And improv, there's still a place for everyone. I've seen people come into his rooms, frozen, upset, irritable, curmudgeonly. They leave with a smile and connecting with other people. It was miraculous. That's why I'm a believer in improv.
Heather, what you're describing is joy. And
yes.
And that seems like, seems like this guy's peddling joy here. What's up with this?
I'm scared of being seen as a Harold Hill. If you make me, he's a joyous man. You hit the word on the head though. Joy really is. And that's why we call our improv sessions a jam for joys. And there's a lot of ways to do improv. And I think that's an interesting thing to drill into, that people popularly know Whose Line Is It Anyway, which is one of the ways I got into it. And it's amazing. It's awesome. Love those players and the way they do it. That's performative. The way we play on purpose is play-based, not performative. In other words, it is to do what Heather said. It is to connect. It is very much, and she nailed another phrase there, come as you are. You could be having a terrible day. You walk in saying, I feel like crap. And we all go, I feel like crap. Hoo-ah! You know, and we reflect that to each other to say, you're totally welcome to feel like crap here. And it's amazing that acknowledgement and that group respect toward being heard has a way of getting people to therefore let go and recognize, oh yeah, that independent lens or individual lens I had of pain, that's only one part of my life. I actually have something to offer somebody else when I open myself up and simply yes and them. No agenda, no joke, nothing. And all of a sudden they feel heard. And now somehow I'm the champion because I yes anded them. What?
Right. And you ushered them in. It's like holding the door open for someone.
Yeah.
It's a very simple gesture, which is available to everyone.
Yep.
Yeah.
So Robert, are there any wrong answers in class?
So you nailed it. There are no wrong answers. That's 100%. And I just did a class today. I do a live class here in Walnut Creek, and we have a dedicated group of about, you know, 7 to 8 people who show up, and some of them have real cognitive issues and in terms of how fast they can speak. So we really take the time to say, take as much time as you need. And we were playing this game where someone had told a story about standing on a glacier in Colorado and how much that meant to him, that feeling like he was on top of the world. He never thought he'd get back there, and it had inspired him, this trip. So I said, well, we're all going to go to that glacier now. And we're going to start, you know, we're going to lead in with, okay, what's on a glacier? And we start reaching out, and there's snow and there's rocks and there's, you know, a hiker shoe somebody left behind. And there might be a little bit of herbage. Absolutely. You know, all of those things fit. And as we did that, now I said, okay, next thing is, who do you want to be? You can be yourself, or you can choose to be someone else, because we had been doing this whole thing about being bigger than ourselves. We stretched our bodies out. We raised our voices and said, we are more than what we understand we are, and we need to practice play with being that. And when I went around the room, 3 of the 5 said they were themselves. One said, I think I'm somebody else, but I'll get back to you. And then the last guy, he was hesitating. And I said to him, no wrong answers. Whatever you say next is perfect. And he said, I'm Joe Biden. And I said, great. And I started talking to him, interviewing him, and he became presidential. And it became this incredible forum about the importance of environmental awareness. And everybody was stepping in, adding their own ability. And President, you know, Biden was saying, and I need you people to help me out. And all of a sudden, you know, the last thing we closed on was we all turned toward the sunset, because someone said how they were up there to see the sunset. He had lived his whole life at sea level. He wanted to see the sunset from altitude. And so we all turned to the sunset and basically said some closing words toward this miraculous thing we were seeing. And then it just, you know, the curtain fell, as it were. And that was all just play-based. It was all based on the moment. It was all made up on what people brought to the group. So my job is just to listen and yes, and anything they bring can become something that all of a sudden is co-creative and therefore gives everybody tremendous power and transformability.
You did that yesterday when we were watching the Shawshank Redemption. Yeah. I could smell the fumes of the car going by and sense it all. You really got all the senses involved.
Yeah. Well, Shawshank is a big deal. I mean, if I don't want to step on anybody, but
and
I
can do the brain.
Yeah. If you want to turn it that way, we could geek out on Shawshank for a bit, but I don't want to step on anybody. You know, we were just already
the trivia. What song is he playing in the courtyard when he locks himself in the guy's office?
It is the opera Figaro.
And why don't they just break the glass to begin with?
Yeah. Well, they you know, it was levels of respect for Andy, right? It was because here he was, this elevated prisoner. And by the way, the warden already was compromised, whether he knew it or not. He needed him. So Andy, my constant refrain to the class is, Andy's playing chess while they're all playing checkers. They think they've got him physically beat to right, whether it's, you know, Boggs and the Bull Queers, or it is, you know, the prison captain Hadley, or if it's Warden Norton. They all think they've got him, not knowing behind the scenes he's chipping away, doing little things to eventually outthink and, you know, through hope and faith, believe he's going to improvise. He's going to figure out his way out of this thing, which he does.
I'm sorry, guys. I'm lost in thought here while he's talking. I feel like you've tapped into like the adolescent brain, and it's kind of genius from my perspective as an exercise professional, because I encourage my clients to play. I encourage them to think like they did when they were children, to get the mind into that plastic state that it was back then, kind of. And it's like you're tapping a very similar thing here. And play is probably one of the biggest words, joy, play. But what does play and just being a kid have to do with all of this?
I love that you brought it up. It's one of our key words. Dr. Stuart Brown is kind of the preeminent play researcher of our time, wrote a book called Play. And that was so deeply important to me during my PhD study to look at that and recognize both he and another guy named Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, who was, and the fact that I can say that name makes me happy. he's a guy who studied flow, right? Being in the moment. And there's a lot of similarities between flow and play, that state of mind of being that allows the freedom, a childlike set of principles, not a childish, right? Which is more behavior based, but childlike, meaning that you have the ability to see the world widely, openly, freely. And again, whatever you do is accepted. And therefore you don't often have to encourage kids to give effort. They engage because they're having fun, right? And now they're going to do their best because of course they're having fun. Right. We set up all sorts of parameters or institutions to monitor, measure, or try to inspire sometimes greater levels of effort. However, left to their own devices and given a safe and brave space in which to play, people will create the most amazing things with confidence, with communication, slowing down, yes, anding others. Yeah, you're right on with the idea of play and the childlike attitude. That's 100% what we're going for.
Heather, I think Gavin would really, really, really be interested in this conversation. I wish he was here, but he keeps popping into my head as we're going through this conversation, not only because he preaches on these things that you're talking about, and he himself can cause the most dramatic transformation in a moment using the exact skills that you're describing here. I'll try and fill in for him and ask great questions, but I know that Gavin, if he was here, would have some awesome questions for you. And on that note, keep him in your thoughts, listeners, if you can. He's going through a really difficult time personally, but I know he's going to be okay because he's got these principles locked in like no other, Robert. And in your personal life, how has this blessed you? All of these things that you've learned for us, this has to be a huge blessing on your own personal life, too, to have all of this wisdom.
Well, thank you for calling it that. And what I feel the blessing is, first and foremost for me, is my relationship with my dad. That was the exploration to take, you know, what were performative arts from acting and, you know, narrative filmmaking, and take them into the personal relationship level, which started with that Boys of Summer documentary. And I don't know how many people on a foundational level get to spend that kind of time with either of their parents to really say, you know, at that point as an adult, who are you and what do I want from the life that we have remaining together? And so Dad and I mean, for the last 20 years, have been able to communicate on a different level with each other because of that honesty, because of that openness. I mean, you know, 2 months, 20,000 miles in a car, you're going to get to know somebody. So we did that. And, you know, it wasn't really until 10 years later in the second film that I introduced improv to him just as a concept. I saw him saying no to things that by that point we had waited for the cure. They said the cure within 10 years. When it didn't happen, it was a real blow to just honestly address the fact that it's probably, as my dad says, it's not going to happen in my lifetime. And for us to go, okay, so now what do we have to do? So we shifted our focus to quality of life and, okay, what can we do? And that's when Dad found for him rock steady boxing. That's when he found ways to engage socially in different ways. And so, you know, I'm giving to my dad and receiving from him what he's doing with it. And then I think the next step forward was Dad absolutely loved the screenings of these films to hear what other people thought of his story being shared. It meant the world to him that it was inspiring other people. And that's when we said, well, we've got to make this about other people. And within that came, you know, the paper about from Northwestern Second City studying the effect of improv on Parkinson's. And that was my one beacon of hope in all the academic papers that said, oh, I could do more with this. And, you know, the doctors at the Lou Ruvo Center said, hey, if you want a seat at the table, because I had said to them, look, I feel like you guys are just standing up there saying the same information over and over again. You're not engaging the people. And they need more than, you know, this is not a medical conference where you're talking to other doctors. They need a different level of engagement. And basically they said, well, if you want to be up here, you got to have the credentials. And that's what led to the PhD program. So from a gift standpoint, it's all kind of like checkbox, keep going, keep listening, keep. And I got to meet so many people along the way, continue to, who, you know, validate, yeah, this is something that's needed. So for me personally, to know that all of this matters is the most important thing. One of my greatest fears in the world is the phrase, nobody cares. That's a prison of its own. That's an isolation space of its own. That leads to worthlessness. That leads to doing it wrong. So to get validation and continue to play and have people say yes, and that gives me the greatest peace I can imagine.
Because you are a pioneer in this particular field, specifically with Parkinson's patients, you've had to do the hard sell and give people what they don't even know they want. Is that correct?
Well said.
Here we are being engaged, which we desperately need, but we don't know what we need.
Well, you know, and again, number one, you're right. It's kind of the Steve Jobs thing of, you don't know you need this, but you're gonna love it so much you're gonna lick it, right? It's just about the iPhone. That within the Parkinson's world, right, who are the thought leaders? Who is defining the institution of Parkinson's? Who's saying this is what we need? And then to me, the whole point is to raise up the voices of the people who aren't being heard, because clearly there's a number of needs that aren't getting met. And that's what the Parkinson's prison is all about. That's what the hero's journey to escape is all about, is helping people discover their own truth about what their story is and recognize, you know, my doctor's version of Parkinson's doesn't line up with my version of Parkinson's. That traumatic experience of the diagnosis is something I've been swimming underwater with since diagnosis. And it might be 10, 15 years down the road. And it's never been addressed. The feelings and the hiding from my family, who don't quite understand and don't know how to talk about it with me. And I'm scared to talk about it with them. And, you know, all of that, which is a moving target because the disease evolves. And by the way, we're all getting older. That has its own challenges. What's Parkinson's? What's aging? Geez, you know, so this is where we have to come to a space of coming together with, what are the common parts within Parkinson's that we can agree upon? You know, to me, it's you know, we as the people with and affected by the care partners, families, are not being listened to at a level that we need to be, right? We need a bigger stake in what's next, as it were. And so how do we do that? Well, we got to raise our voice through stories that matter. It's not the surface level stories. We see a lot of that. We see calls for action. Tell us your story. If you don't know how to tell a story, and there are a ton of barriers around why you wouldn't know how to tell a story, well, then, you know, you're just going to say, yeah, I'm fine. I go to my rock steady class and I try to eat well. And, you know, I go to my support group, and that might all be true, but that's not a story. That's a recitation of facts.
You're not actually working together in many of those situations either. You have to work together with improv. You can't do it alone.
That's right.
It's kind of weird.
Agreed. Because what do people say about when it comes to, you know, the psychosocial? This is the part of Parkinson's that's widely underaddressed. Two things I hear anyway are cognitive behavioral therapy, which is fine for those who it works with. That, again, though, is one-on-one, right? And then the second is support groups. Well, I mean, peel back the layer and let's get honest with what's a support group. That means 1,000 different things to 1,000 different people. And again, for the ones that work great, I hear an awful lot of feedback about them not working the way people wish they were, because some of them tend to become gripe fests. They'll bite to the bottom, the worst of the worst.
I wrote down a few words while you were talking. It satisfies the loneliness by, you know, it takes that from us, which is kind of nice. The play, the energetic nature of it gives you energy, gives you a little boost. You know, when someone else is excited about something, even if you're just having mudita, which would be sympathetic joy, you know, I'm seeing you have joy, I have joy. Like the people laughing on the bus that you mentioned, it gives them a purpose, you know, reason to kind of show up, and helps us speak our truth and our stories. Therefore, allowing, once again, back to the first thing, how we fit in with others.
Yes.
That's all right. It all is.
If isolation is the biggest problem, and I would posit that it is, then that answering that question that you just brought up, how we fit in with others, is the answer, right? And yes. That's what we need to interconnect.
Yes, and.
Heather did it. She made me laugh finally. All right. And done. So, Robert, you said something earlier. It was the word flow. And I've been sitting here thinking, what would Gavin ask if he was here? And it would be on that topic, I would bet. And I want to first, it's a two-part question, have you describe what is flow? And then how is it useful in Parkinson's? And do you have an inclination that it's a usable placebo against Parkinson's symptoms?
Yes, to the last part first. So number one, placebo is not a bad word. It is something that if it works for you, do it. I want to make very clear that neither improvisation nor storytelling are meant as a silver bullet. They're not an answer. They're not a cure. They are usable, tangible interventions for you to unlock yourself, right? So first and foremost, those things. When it comes to what is flow? Flow is a state of mind. It is a feeling that one can get to, and many people talk about the zone from an athletic standpoint, that one might get the runner's high, that one might, if playing a game of basketball, feel they just can't miss, like the bucket is suddenly, as big as an ocean, they're just throwing it up and everything's going in. You can get it, from writing where you just get lost in the page. You can get it from cooking, from gardening, from a conversation. Being engaged in nature, green exercise has all of this flow to it. So there are several stages that Mihai talks about within this place, and that, very importantly, it doesn't have a goal attached to it. It has being lost in the moment. It has being pleasurable in the moment and feeling like you're not giving any effort, that it's just, it's happening through you. You're tapping into something larger. It's when the skill meets the challenge, if you could see those things in an XY axis, right? So it's appropriate level skill, your own skill, meeting the appropriate level challenge. If it's not challenging enough, you're going to be bored. If it requires more skill than you have, you might be turned off. Think, oh no, that's not for me, or I can't, right? So where your challenge meets the skill, or your skill meets the challenge of whatever it is you're taking on, that is when flow can and does happen. And it often happens in improvisation when we lose ourselves to the moment with the participant we're playing with, when we can say yes and we release what's happening next. What happens next is based on what you said. It's not what I'm going to say. I'm yes anding you. So that's where flow intersects with all of this.
So it sounds to me like flow is actually attached to the rest of the conversation we were having, which is really you're empowering people to use their own discernment. Whereas I feel like flow is almost an instantaneous belief in your own discernment, so much so that you feel like you can do anything. Does that make sense?
Yeah. The instantaneous, it's an immediate yes and, right? To put it back in those terms, that you once again, you're more than perhaps you thought you were in a Parkinson's prison sense. And by the way, when I say Parkinson's prison, it's any self-limiting belief system. So could this be applied to people without Parkinson's? Absolutely. Because lots of us limit ourselves based on the stories of others or stories that we have indoctrinated ourselves with. So anything that a flow state, think of Andy in the Shawshank Redemption, putting on the Figaro song from Mozart, where he not only was flowing for himself, but he shared that flowing gift with others. He released those prisoners. He locked out the prison guards and locked out the warden, and he released the prisoners with that song through a flow state of opera. That right there, for a minute, everyone was free, right? So music can absolutely be a beginning of a flow state.
Mike, do you ever get into situations where you feel like you're kind of in that flow state and you're speaking better? Does it ever help? Or have you ever noticed that, Mike?
I have. I'm very comfortable in the moment. I'm talking in front of people, that's why I tend to seize up a little bit. It's like I am right now.
Yeah, confidence is another key term. I think maybe Heather even has that written down.
I'm going to argue with you for a minute here. I don't think it has anything to do with confidence. I think it's about taking the ego and putting the ego into the passenger in the back seat and going, oh, you're upset. Take your little lollipop and hang out over here for a few minutes. It's about getting out of our own way. It's about not worrying about how we're coming off. Just like Robert said, it's not performative at all. In fact, if you were a peacock, you'd still spread your feathers out in a quiet little contained courtyard. It's the joy of just doing it. Like I have paintings behind me. I don't paint for anybody else. I just do it because I can't help it.
The result can look like confidence. And I agree that it's, you know, the not stepping in and saying, I'm going to be confident. You've already lost it because you put the I into it. Like Heather says, it's in the backseat. I've lost myself and I'm just doing because this is enjoyable and I am, you know, exploring whatever it is and, you know, allowing the next thing, as Michael said earlier, to come out of my mouth or, you know, to be written on the page or the next stroke on the canvas. That's the flow. That's what happens. That's the release. From a science standpoint, confidence is a measurable. And so, yes, you know, when we talk about outcomes, we talk about confidence, creativity, and communication, the three C's. I think what Heather brings forward is a good point, though, is not to confuse confidence with ego and release so that the feeling is freedom. The feeling is freedom.
So, Robert, can you explain the 16, as briefly as you can, the course outline?
Absolutely. So the day one, Parkinson's prison, the hero's journey to escape refers to day one is the day of diagnosis. I had heard from enough people that day of diagnosis was traumatic. And I know that's not everybody's story, but it's enough people's story to say, okay, we've got something we're going to jump into, to where we recognize that there are some limitations and therefore we want to escape from them. So the hero's journey for our purpose starts with the ordinary world, which is life before Parkinson's. And just considering that opens a lot of people up to, gosh, yeah, you're right. I was a person who had some different thoughts, dreams, beliefs, hopes for that life before Parkinson's. And then stage two is the call to adventure, which is the day of diagnosis. And, you know, exactly, I try to limit the writers to that moment. What did you hear? What did you feel? What did the doctor say? Who were you with? You know, did you tell people? Did you hide? What were your immediate feelings, right? And then the refusal of the call is stage three, which is very common. Not everyone experiences it right there, but a lot of people do hide. Either from themselves or from others, maybe groups of others. They're going to be limited in who they tell because of fear, of stigma, of judgment, all those things. By the way, any of these stages can be told in any order and may show up in different places. This is just how we present them. So there's a refusal of the call, and then there's a meeting with the mentor. So often the mentor appears when the student is ready, right? So the student, by refusing the call, may bump into that person who says, hey, by the way, what you're doing either sucks or is going to make you get more sick unless you get with the program. There's more of you to be discovered. It's time to wake up. You've been sleeping, as Campbell says. And the mentor basically helps the hero get on his or her way to cross the threshold from the ordinary world into the special world. Crossing the threshold is, oh my God, it's that moment of, wow, what am I doing? Who am I going to become in this new space? What is the new me in this place? And this is where we encourage people to mythologize themselves. Say, you know what? You don't have to be the rote version of yourself just reciting facts. If you want to make yourself into an alpha wolf, if you want to now be, you know, Leah the dragon slayer, you can become whatever you want to go on this journey to retell your story through kind of a one-off distant space, so you have freedom to assess your life not in a linear path, but in a metaphorical, mythological way that says, gosh, I've been hiding some truths. And now as the bad guys get, you know, represented as a dragon who might be, you know, a parent, might be an old coach, might be an old boss, anybody that stuck us with this behavior, all of those things draw us into a different place. So, right. So now that we're into the special world, into stage five, we've accepted the journey, we're committed to it. We go to stage six. Tests, allies, and enemies. We've got to, you know, we're in the training phase. We got to figure stuff out. We're going to get knocked down. We're going to figure out what's next. And we're going to figure out, now stepping into stage seven, the approach to the inmost cave. We want something. We've decided, okay, now that I'm in this special place, I want something. And with a clear want or a need comes a clear fear of I might not get it or I'm scared. So we put those things in exact opposition with each other, and we go into the ordeal, stage 8. There's some kind of fight, some kind of collision that happens in that space, and you come out of that ordeal probably scarred, probably hit a little bit. However, you've been victorious in some fashion. You gain some kind of reward. It might be psychological. It might be actual. You might have a flaming sword +5. I don't know. Or you might have greater confidence. However, what you have is something to take forward. You then journey back to the road back, which means you're going to take that thing, because this journey wasn't just for you. It is, how do I bring this back to the people who are affected by this to make the ordinary world better? And as you go toward stage 10, the road back, guess what? Those people you fought in the ordeal, they don't let you go lightly. They're not like, oh, good, you beat me. They want back what you're trying to steal, right? You're Prometheus stealing the fire, as it were, from the underworld. So you come up now into stage 11, into the resurrection. Something has to die. It may be something literal. It may be something figurative. It could be a belief system. It could be something you're carrying with you. It could be anything, but something has to die. And you are reborn as a new version of yourself, this hero who gets to return stage 12 with the elixir and say, this is not for me. This is for all of you. In Shawshank world, the elixir was the hope. That was the final gift he gave Red. Red was at the point of dying, remember? He was going to kill himself, just like Brooks did, a dark mentor. But the one thing that kept him was the final gift that Andy gave him. Go to that unlikely brick wall or rock wall in Buxton and find that impossible black rock and find that box I left for you to let you know that hope is real and hope is powerful and positive and it can lead you to a new life. And that's where, you know, again, the hero's journey begins again as you come back to a new ordinary world redefined.
Powerful and positive. That sounds like a very good description for this course. What's your favorite part of this experience? Just you personally, what do you love about working with people with Parkinson's, and what's your favorite part about what they take away from this course?
When I hear people literally yes and, when I see them have the transformative experiences like Heather mentioned earlier, maybe they come in a bad mood or uncertain or skeptical, and I yes and them to say, yeah, feel all of that, question all of that, question me 100%. And then they start making discoveries, and they teach me things all the time. I mean, in the last group, they came about, one of the players, about 7 to 8 weeks in, when we were really pushing toward, what is it you really want? And he said, well, the truth is, I'm angry that there's not a cure. I'm, you know, almost 20 years in, and I just think it's both not fair and not right. And you the ripple across the classroom was huge. He affected me deeply because I, too, had kind of just said, well, the cure is not going to come. And I said, wait a minute, that doesn't mean we should stop just because it's impossible. Doesn't mean we should stop fighting for it. And by this is exactly what we're here for, is to raise our voices and to come forward and to watch them lead the charge on that. Deeply inspirational. So they nicknamed me Sherpa. In fact, Sherpa Andy, from that, you know, that I get to be that type of guide. I'm not there to carry anybody. I'm not there to tell them what their journey is. I'm there to point out interesting stuff along the way and give them hope and opportunity that will help them tell their story. And it's all about them. Just keep making it about, you know, and when they reflect on each other, you see them giving gifts and lifting each other up. That's the great stuff, man.
I can think of so many times in my life where I'm so glad that I said yes, you know, even something so small. And I'm thinking about, you know, how do we direct people towards you? And I'm thinking, well, they just have to say yes, first of all, to doing this, get over that hump of this is uncomfortable and it's not really my forte. You know, I did that myself with Darby Schlosser's program. I was really not thinking it would be for me. And then look at me now. I wouldn't be here with you guys if I wouldn't have just simply said yes and taken the training. And I would like to encourage people listening to say yes to Robert here. And if they aren't encouraged to do so, Robert, how would they get a hold of you to start classes?
You bet. Yesandexercise.org is the website. For the writing program, you'll see day one has the page with everything on it. And for the improv program, it'll say, it says sign up. And we have online improv classes twice a week that we encourage people to come and try it out, to just say, throw some stuff at the wall. The writing class is a 16-week curriculum. So that's a bigger investment, you know, of time. And there is a tuition for that, which we could talk about. There's all sorts of fundraising opportunities. The Jam for Joy is a suggested $20 donation, just, you know, the same way you would do for a Dance for PD or Rocksteady type of class. And it's a drop-in. Just show up whenever you can feel it. That's the two programs.
That'll do it for this week's show, everybody. Check out Robert's website at Yes and Exercise. It's YESANDEXERCISE.org. YesAndExercise.org. Have a great night, everybody. But does she really want her? But can't stand to see me walk out the door.
Shake it, 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 sh